Okay, a few announcements before we begin. Obviously, after class today, we'll have to break down. There will be a no class Wednesday, Thursday, and then all the following week, we will resume back here on Sunday, which is, I believe, the 30th of September. As you know, we will have a short business meeting for the members after or at the end of second session today to vote on adopting the bylaws. And thirdly, we have revised and revamped, didn't make a whole lot of changes, but we have one official policy on file, which is the Living Grace policy. So these are available, again, electronically or in written form if you are interested. Okay, that's it. Let's make sure you are in fellowship and continue on here dealing with this issue of the competitive workaholic who denies himself everything in life, has no one to share it with or leave it to. And Solomon sees all that as being, again, so much more of another waste of time. So we're dealing with the fact that the individual, under point 30, that is constantly striving to get more and is never content with what God provides. And Hebrews 13:5 was the last one we didn't get to. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money. This is something that people have to fight against. And again, particularly in our culture, we recognize that at certain times in history, certain people, certain believers faced bigger tests in certain areas than believers in other times in history faced. And in some cases, you know, believers in a particular period of history, or depending on where they live geographically, may face, you know, persecution that other believers don't face. In this case, we don't face the temptations associated with too little. We face the temptations associated with too much. This is, again, promoted and set forth as what people ought to be doing. And, in fact, the Bible is, you know, pretty much opposed to it, as we know. So let your character be free from the love of money, being content with what you have. And the reasoning here is because he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I forsake you. So that we may confidently say, the Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What will man do to me? And again, let the heathen rage, we might say. But ultimately, they're not going to come to anything. God takes care of the positive believer. We'll work things out, assuming the believer is patient and will allow God to do so. And be content, and just whatever you have, you have. And if that's your attitude, you'll do fine. It's when the attitude becomes, I've got to have more, or I'm not content, or I'm not happy. 31, Paul indicated that contentment can become a learned behavior. Therefore, do not make excuses for yourself or others that refuse to be satisfied with God's provision. Philippians 4:11. So, and I would assume from what Paul says here that it isn't just simply that it can become a learned behavior, that he himself had learned it. Which would indicate that this was an area that he may have struggled with at some level. And again, people tend to get these romantic ideas about the Bible at some level, and particularly the people in them, that they were somehow way different or better than we are, or all of that. When in fact, they're very similar in a lot of ways. And again, they face many of the same problems, same STA. See, the good thing is STA doesn't change, does it? It doesn't matter what generation you live in. There's always going to be lust, pride, greed, and all the mental attitude sins. Then there's also going to always be the verbal sins of slander, gossip, maligning. Then there's going to be the overt sins, murder, rape, adultery, etc., etc., etc. So in that regard, the STA doesn't really change. It just acclimates at some level to whatever period in history it finds itself. And certain things are promoted, maybe, that appeal to different aspects of the STA at different times. But Philippians 4:11, not that I speak from want. And he's commending the Philippians. In fact, this was really the primary reason, one of the primary reasons this book was written, was the Philippians were one of the few groups that supported Paul monetarily and did so on a consistent basis. Whereas the Corinthians, who were far more wealthy and had much more in terms of money in the details, did not tend to support Paul. In fact, Paul would not take money from them because he had a specific spiritual reason to shut up the gainsayers and the naysayers out there who said, well, Paul's just in all this for the money. And so he demonstrated to them, I won't take a penny from you. But he didn't have these same, he didn't have qualms about taking money from, say, the Thessalonians or the Philippians. So it wasn't as though Paul didn't understand the principle, because he clearly sets it forth, in fact, in the book of Corinthians, that those who make their living, preach the gospel, as it were, should make their living from the gospel. And he just says, we haven't used any of those things with you people in order to shut their mouths so they would not have any legitimate or even non-legitimate complaints about Paul. And he also did it to shut down the false teachers, who all themselves were busy, you know, always taking money. They did not do what they did out of a love of doctrine and a love of God and all of that. Many of them were in it for the money. So Philippians 4:11, and so the Philippians sent him this monetary gift. And he said in verse 10, you know, you were concerned, I recognize, but you didn't have an opportunity to do so. But now you've had the opportunity and you've taken it. And not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. Which indicates to me that, again, that this was something he himself had to work on. That it was, you know, it isn't as though Paul was a spiritual giant that had every area of doctrine all squared away at all times. He failed in certain areas and struggled, as believers do. He admits publicly in Corinthians there that he had a tendency towards pride, and that God gives him this thorn in the flesh in order to hinder all that. And now he's, you know, if you read his writings carefully, here you see that he had to learn to be content, just like we all have to learn to be content. At some level, and just let God provide and wait on him. Humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, etc., and let him exalt you at the proper time. So not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. And that's a real art, to be able to do both of those things. To be able to say, okay, I don't have very much, but that's fine, I don't need very much. And then on the other hand, for God to bless you, if God provides some prosperity in your life, to be able to handle that with grace. And I've met people on both ends of the spectrum on this one. There are some people, they have a measure of prosperity and they handle it very well. They're very low key. They don't tend to act like they're any better than anybody else. And I've seen people that get blessed with a little prosperity and suddenly they're better than everybody else. They all, you know. So those type of people to me are obnoxious. They can't handle prosperity. And prosperity has destroyed some believers. Outside of the obnoxious nature of the way they handle it, the fact that they just can't handle it. So in any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and of going hungry, of having abundance and suffering need. And then, of course, he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. It's the internal strength that's supplied through doctrine that allows believers to orient to these principles. And so, again, he commends them for their offering and all of that. He low-keys it, of course, but says, look, I'm not in this for the money. Not that I seek the gift, verse 17, but I seek the profit which increases to your account. He recognizes they function properly under grace giving, that they were laying up rewards. And that is one area, obviously, where a person can glorify God and lay up reward when we low-key it as well, as much as possible. We just pass the plate around, you do what you do. And but if you apply in fellowship with the right mental attitude, the right motivation, and all of that, God's going to reward that. And so, as it were, he'll take your money and turn it into SG3. That's a pretty good investment, because SG3 is going to last forever. And that is something you actually will have forever. Whereas our money, obviously, it's going to die with us, as it were. We're not going to take it out. So 32, do not think that the continual desire to have more money, more details, or to habitually replace perfectly good items with newer models is anything more than the STA activity it is. And we're not talking, again, about there's a balance to this. But I'm talking about people that are continually consumed with this. I've got my 60-inch television, but they came out with a 72. I got to have it. I need it. Well, you won't be any happier with a 72 than you are with a 60. And so, but if you got a TV that's 20 years old and you know, the picture doesn't work right and the sound doesn't work and all of that, and God help you if your remote breaks. You know, I remember when I was a kid, we actually had to get up and go to turn the television on and off. We suffered. So, but I'm talking about the people that are constantly pursuing this. And again, they've got in the computer business, they've got people on this treadmill. You got to get a bigger, better computer. You got to get a bigger, better product. Got to get upgrade your software, etc. All the time. No, you don't. No, you don't. No, you don't. Again, those people that are continually consumed with this, and you'll see, because they'll be laying up, you'll always have more new details. That this is their life. They're consumed with it. Consumed with shopping. We all have to shop. I recognize that. You got to shop sometimes. But there are people that think it's an art form to go shopping. And that's all you ever hear them talk about. It's their newest, latest, greatest deal. I don't care. I get tired of hearing that. So, again, if you got things that work and are fine, be happy with them. Enjoy them. You don't have to replace them every 5 years. And so you got things that need to be replaced. And, okay, get them done. Replace it. But, again, there's a difference here in the mental attitude of being willing to do it and the mental attitude of, oh, I got to do it all the time. There's a huge difference. So 33, in this case, the man in view continued to work ceaselessly, amassed significant wealth, and was still not satisfied with what he had earned and accumulated. 34, although Koheleth has been referring to the lonely miser in the third person, the latter part of this verse introduces an abrupt transition into the first person. 35, some commentators believe that Koheleth now reveals the autobiographical nature of his example at this point. But most simply see him identifying with the man so closely that he has the individual speak in the first person. So some are suggesting here that Koheleth is the lonely miser. But I don't think so. I don't think that's the case. Number one, we know that he had a significant family and that he had an heir and all that. He had a son. So I don't think this is autobiographical at all. I don't think he's talking about himself. I think he just shifts to the first person to make this more plain here at some level and more graphic for us to draw attention to it. He puts himself in the mind of the man, as it were. So 36, it would seem unlikely that Koheleth is referring to himself in this verse, since he would have known that he did not fit the description of the man in view. Koheleth knew that he had an heir. Now, he might have thought Rehoboam was an idiot, and maybe he had already figured out Rehoboam was an idiot. I don't know. But he did definitely know he had a son that was going to take over the kingdom. That much he knew from prophecy. And obviously, the guy was there. He could see him. So he knew that he was going to hand the kingdom over to his son. He knew there was going to be some discipline in his son's reign. If he's a very smart dad, he's figured out certain things about his son by now, because the son's probably, like I say, again, I would say late 20s to mid-30s, somewhere in there, given whatever time he wrote this. So clearly, by that time, you've kind of figured out the character, if you haven't, figured out the character of your kids by the time they're 30. You're not a very astute parent. 37, some see the direct question as words spoken by the lonely workaholic, as he asks himself, why is he doing what he's doing? And 38, others see the question as something he never asks himself, indicating that he is so immersed in his chosen course of action that he never stops to consider why he's doing what he's doing. Now, the New American Standard, clearly in their translation here, they said, and he never asked. They tell you what their interpretation is by the words they supply, that he never asked himself. The difference in force would be that the question itself kind of demands a negative answer. Who am I, if he's asking himself this, who am I doing this for? Why am I depriving myself? Who, if he's asking the question? And the difference in force would be, if he's asking the question, he's recognized that this is stupid, that I'm denying myself, I'm laboring and denying myself pleasure, and I'm not doing it for anybody. There isn't even a point to this. And of course, if he doesn't ask the question, the idea here is that he's stupid. So either his course of action is stupid or he's stupid, but in either case, it's not good. And in either case, whether no matter what, the question here demands a negative answer. The answer is nobody. There's nobody I'm denying myself for. And that's, well, why would I sacrifice then? Why don't I enjoy this? So again, some others see the question as something he never asks himself. That he never asks himself. Why is he doing what he's doing? Well, 39, in either case, the rhetorical question anticipates a negative answer. There is no one for whom he is denying himself certain pleasures. 40, he is not pleasing himself, as seen by the question, why does my soul lack good? And again, good not being, I don't think, in a moral sense here, but more in the sense of pleasure or enjoyment in life and that sort of thing. Because Solomon uses that word in this book. He does use it in a moral sense. So he's not pleasing himself, and he has no one to share with whom to share his blessing. Nor does he have anyone to whom he will leave all his property. And 41, this story would serve to reinforce the moderate proverb from verse 7, demonstrating that one hand full of some joy or contentment, a balance between work and rest, is more valuable than two hands full of details. All the fruit of his labor he's got, but what does he really have at the end of it all? And at a certain level, people will find out in life that not having someone to share things with is very disconcerting. It's not a fun way to live life. And so there is a value, there is a real value, as we'll see here, as he introduces it with this verse here, and then continues to move on with it in the following verses. There's a real value to companionship. And Solomon doesn't, in the next verses we're going to see, he doesn't even necessarily say it's good to have a wise companion, which we would all agree with, of course. Yeah, if the companion is wise, that's far more helpful. But he just says just a companion is superior to no companion. And he'll cite several examples of why it is. So again, the story here would serve to reinforce the moderate proverb of verse 7, again, about a balance in life. This guy's got no contentment. He's got no pleasure in life. That's not much of a life, is it? 42, the last portion of this verse labels this situation as another form of vanity, uselessness, fruitlessness, or absurdity. 43, the term inyan, which is the term task, denotes that which keeps a person busy, a task, business, or occupation. And when coupled with the adjective ra, evil, it denotes, and again these various translations are translated grievous vexation in the Douay version, unhappy business in the Revised Standard Version and the New English Translation, sorry business in the New English Bible and Moffat, miserable business in the NIV, worthless task, the New American Bible, grievous task, as we've got it, the New American Standard, and a sorry situation, the MLB. And I like the last one there, sorry situation. The Modern Living Bible, that's how they translate it. This is a sorry situation, isn't it? Yeah, it is. It's a sorry situation if that's the way you're going to live life. This guy is in a bad state of affairs. And again, the question I still would have is, does he ever stop and ask himself this, or does he not stop and ask himself this? But in either case, again, it's not a positive thing. All right, here we'll have some further advantages of companionship. And these now through verse 12, we'll see. And again, we would certainly say, it would be good to have a wise companion, but he's going to say, no, it's good to just have a companion. Anybody is better than nobody. Now, sometimes you may look around and think, no, that's not true. But generally speaking, it is. And he's going to cite the specific examples he cites would tend to show that. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their labor. And what you're going to have here, and we're going to have this set up several times, you have tov, and they don't always follow one another right away, but they may be separated in the text by a number of terms. Good, the word for good, the noun for good, good from. And this is just the Hebrew idiom for saying something is better than something else. If something is good from something, it's better than that. So you have here good or better, actually, as the way they've translated it, the two. You got the definite article here plus the masculine dual adjective of shene. Now that word means exactly that, S-H, oops, that's a shawa, S-H-E-N-A, where am I at here, S-H-N-A-Y-I-M, Shanaim, from the one. Two are better than one. Good the two from the one, literally. The definite article plus the word ekad, again, for one. Which, and the relative particle here, is almost used in a causal sense, which is, it can be used that way. Normally I would expect ki here, but he does use the relative particle in a number of ways. And I think one part of the deal was Solomon was so intelligent and so well read that language to him was pretty fluid. He was able to deal with it, I think, and use words in ways that other people, and that's one of the things you see if you study the book carefully. When you get into the language and the grammar of it, he uses words that sometimes aren't used till 400 or 500 years later regularly. And so that's why they've suggested, well, he didn't write this. This book was written much later. No, he wrote it. It's just that he is so smart and so intelligent and so well-read that he had a real ability with languages that probably other people didn't have. And, of course, with his exposure to all these other cultures and all that, he probably knew several languages. That wouldn't surprise me. The relative particle here actually is a share, which, but we might say in that or because there exists to them, adverb of existence, yesh, to them is the prefix lamed plus the third masculine singular suffix, the two, we might say. There exist wages, this word is sakar, S-A-K-H-A-R, wages, compensation, pay, return, reward. There exists wages, good. They have a good return or better even. They can make a better wage. Obviously, they can get more done. That's one of the things, obviously, is two people can be more productive than one, as you might expect. And again, in this case, it would matter if the one was a complete idiot, because they might not be more productive. They might just get in your way. So prefix bait here, you got good plus, and then you have the prefix bait, because good, literally in them, or for them, and they translate it for their labor, and then the word amal again, hard work, labor, toil. For if either one of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. Because again, conjunction key here, which is what I would have expected earlier, but we got our share. If is the particle, the hypothetical im, I am. If either of them falls, and here, and again, the hypothetical isn't always hypothetical. You have to understand that it can shade into, and here it does, shades into the idea of sense. If either one of them falls, he's not saying maybe they will, maybe they won't. This anticipates that somebody might fall out there in life. If either one of them falls, the one will lift up his companion. If either of them, literally, they will fall, the one is what you have. Nafail is the verb. That means just exactly that, to fall. N-A-P-H-A-L. If will fall the one, either one of them is the way they translate it, which is fine. Definite article plus the adjective, akad again. The one will lift up his companion. Hifil, imperfect here, of kum. The hifil is the causative stem, Q-U-M, will cause to rise, literally. So the word is translate lift up or help up. He will cause to rise. The sign of the direct object here plus the masculine singular noun with the third masculine suffix of kaver. C-H-A-B-H-E-R. And that word means associate or companion. It denotes a close relationship here, but it's based on choice. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. But is translated here the adversative use of wow. And the interjection here is E, apostrophe I-Y. Woe or alas. And if you've ever seen some of it, you'll see these people in the Mideast. They'll be screaming this at the top of their voice. Their expression of grief. And that's why that's what the word means here. So woe, alas, is the idea. Woe to the one. Prefix lamed plus a third masculine singular suffix. And then you have the definite article plus the adjective, again, akad. Woe to the one who falls. You got the relative particle here prefixed as just a sheen. With the cal imperfect of nafail, who will fall, who might fall, we might say. This is almost here conditional. Woe to the one who might fall, and there does not exist, while plus the adverb ayin, there does not exist a second. Sheni, again, the word for second, to cause him to rise, literally. There is not another to lift him up. Is again, you have the causative use here, or the causative stem, the hiphil. Furthermore, if two lie down together, they keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Again, the conjunction gam here serves as introducing another article additionally, or then they translate it furthermore, which is fine. Or likewise, if, again, the hypothetical particle im, if they will lie down, the two, shakab is the word, S-H-A-K-H-A-B-H, shakav. They will lie down. That word means exactly that, to lie down, to recline. Two, and then you have a wow consecutive plus the cal perfect of kamam. C-H-A-M-A-M. This word means to become warm or hot. It refers here to physical heat that's produced by the sun, the body, the clothing, or even an oven, so we all know, you know, what to warm something up is. And if the two lie down, they've supplied the idea here together, they keep warm. You got the wow consecutive, it's the count perfect, they will keep warm. It actually changes it to the force of an imperfect. There will be warmth, there will be warmth to them. Prefix lamed plus the third masculine plural suffix. But how can one be warm alone? And to the one, but to the one, or when there is just one, we might say. You've got, again, the lamed plus a cattle. This is the same vocabulary, the adjective there for one. The interrogative particle is ache. A-Y-K. How? And then you've got a cal imperfect, third masculine singular. How will he be warm? And the answer, of course, this presupposes a no answer. He can't. He won't. And the idea, of course, is in an environment where it's cold, as desert nights very often are. The temperature can go from these great extremes of very hot at night, 110, 120 degrees, down to the 40s. And you get out in that at night, and I mean, you can get chilled to the bone. And so there was a custom, certainly, it was, and it still exists today, that people recognize in these situations the body heat of two people is better, provides more heat than the body heat of one. And if one can overpower him who is alone, here's a third example, or actually the fourth one. If one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. And if, here you got a wow plus, again, the hypothetical particle im, if or since, again, it shades into the nuance, because this is something we know, is that one can overpower somebody who's by himself. He can take him by surprise, and you got advantage of surprise and all that, and maybe even strength, who knows. Then you got the cal imperfect third masculine singular plus the third masculine singular suffix of taqef. T-A-Q-E-P-H. This word's only used four times. It means to overpower or to prevail over somebody. And if one can prevail, beat down, overpower, the one, the definite article here plus the word a cat again, one, the two of them, definite article, plus the masculine dual adjective again, shenayim, the two of them will stand. Cal imperfect, third masculine plural of Ahmad, A-M-A-D-H. And the idea of stand here is will prevail. They will be able to stand against him, we might say. That's kind of the nuance of it. And actually, that's the way it would probably best be translated. Two can resist him, two can stand against him. You got the preposition here, neged. N-E-G-H-E-D-H. Neged means before or prominent. Here it's used in the sense of opposition. The two will stand against him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. And why would he sell that? Well, again, he's strengthening his point here that there's strength in numbers. And so, again, this is one of the reasons, I think, certainly you can make the application off of this, is that why does the divide and conquer principle work so well? Because there is known strength in numbers. And divide and conquer always works because you cull out, as it were, one person. And they're much easier to convince and overpower, in a physical sense, if you're fighting, much easier to whip than if there are three of them that stand in there together who are unified against you. So a cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. And is a wow here, the cord. Again, you got the definite article, but it's used in a generic sense here. The word is cut, C-H-U-T. This means a thread, a string, or a cord. And then you got the definite article plus the pu-al participle of shalash, S-H-A-L-A-S-H. Shalash, nine times only in the PL and the PUL, which are the intensive stems. So the word means to do three times. So when you have it used the way you've got here, the PUL, which is the passive intensive stem, a cord being done three times. And so they've translated a cord of three strands, which is fine. Is not quickly torn apart. Is not torn apart as the negative low plus the nifal imperfect of nafak, N-A-T-H-A-Q. Literally will not be because it's actually an imperfect. The word means to pull out, draw out, pluck out, or to tear something apart. For instance, it's used in Psalm 2:3 in that sense. Here in the prophecy of the conspiracy of the last days, the international conspiracy that exists, but the conspiracy is really against God. In verse 3, let us tear their fetters apart and cast their cords from us. There to tear apart is the one we're looking for, their fetters apart, to tear them apart. So again, a threefold cord is not torn apart, will not be torn apart literally, in haste. Prefix bait here plus the adverb of mehera, M-E-H. E-R-A-H. And this word means 20 times it's used haste or speed. So the prefix bait here with haste would translate into how they've done it here in the New American Standard. Will not be torn apart quickly. And we are going to stop there today. I don't want to dive into this. We need to have a brief meeting. So we will pick up here. We'll break down afterwards, I guess, today. And then pick up here 2 weeks from today. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls and keep us safe until we come together again to continue the pursuit of your word. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.